At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit Tenable.com. Tenable, your exposure ends here.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about the Nibelungenlied by an unknown poet, very much like the Beowulf poet as well. We don't know who actually wrote this, but what I can tell you about it is that it is estimated to have been written between the late 12th century and the early 13th century, so about 1200 AD, and it is one of the most famous and influential pieces of German literature of all time, of course, hailing from the height of the medieval period. And the Nibelungenlied is a very, very interesting story because not only is it written very much in the style of people like Thomas of Britain and Christian de Troyes, who wrote many of the Arthurian romances, but what's more, it has one of the most dark and sinister stories of revenge I've ever read. In fact, this story for many centuries disappeared after the medieval era and was rediscovered by local German man back in about 1755. And so since then, since its rediscovery over many, many centuries, it became known as something of the Northern Iliad. This is how the Germans, of course, framed it themselves, wanting to be very, very proud of their own achievements. Although I don't think that many people would say that it is on par with the Iliad itself, I would say it is still a remarkable achievement and gives a great window into the fusion of myth and legend and history. All of these coming together in the understanding of Germanic peoples and their own history. Because a lot of the characters in this, unlike in Beowulf, where really the only character who has any real historical grounding is Hygelac, the king of the Geats, in this, many of the characters are inspired by real historical figures. Now, this doesn't mean at all that the things that they do in the novel, in the work, are one-for-one replications of the actual historical accounts of these people, but they do represent a very, very interesting image of the oral tradition of storytelling passing down from the Germanic migration period between about 300 and 600, both from the wavering end of the Western Roman Empire and into the start of the Dark Ages, before we have any actual written works of epic Germanic poetry that came about in Germany in about 830 with the Hildebrandelied, which is a tale all about Hildebrand. But as it says here, we have the Nibelungenlied. So it is the lay of the Nibelungs. It's a song of their tragedy, of their fate, of their doom. And what's also interesting about this story as well is that in addition to a very, very strong written work for the German people as well, you also have a remarkably strong tradition with Old Norse, when you look at Norse works, such as the Volsunga saga and the Poetic Edda, both compiled after the Nibelungenlied was actually published by about 70 years or so in some cases, there is a remarkable amount of overlap between the events of this and the events of the Norse counterparts. Now, the Norse counterparts are a more extensive story. If the Nibelungenlied begins with the tale of Siegfried, one of the main characters of this, then the Norse version starts right back at the depths of time with the pagan gods themselves, with Odin and Loki and the dwarves and this ring of Andvari. And many of these things will go on to be immortalized in the remarkable famous work of Richard Wagner in his Ring Cycle, in which he lays out this grand 15-hour opera in four parts, where he goes through the beginning of the Nibelung treasure, right? It's a treasure of the Nibelung people. This keeps getting passed down the generations, and the treasure in it is actually cursed. Although, as we'll see when I read this version, the treasure is still present, but less important than it is in the Norse version. And so I will absolutely get round to discussing such things as the Volsunga saga and the Poetic Edda in the future, but I have one or two guests that I'd really like to rope in for that. So for the time being, let us talk all about the Nibelungenlied. And just to say as well, what I've done for this particular set of chronicles, the events of the Nibelungenlied are so epic, it's so eventful, it's so packed with action and characters and plot and deception that what I've done is I've split the story into two parts. So in this episode, we'll talk all about part one, and in the next episode, we'll talk about part two. Obviously, you can all count to two. So we'll begin with the events and the story of part one. Our story begins with these words. We have been told in ancient tales many marvels of famous heroes, of mighty toils, joys, and high festivities, of weepings and wailings, and the fighting of bold warriors. Of such things you can now hear wonders unending. In the land of the Burgundians, there grew up a maiden of high lineage, so fair that none in any land could be fairer. Her name was Kriemhild. She came to be a beautiful woman, causing many knights to lose their lives. This charming girl was as if made for love's caresses. She was desired by brave fighting men, and none was her enemy. For graces did the young lady possess, that she was the adornment of her sex. She was in the care of three great and noble kings, the renowned warriors Gunther and Gerno, and young Gisler, a splendid knight, and she was sister to these princes who had the charge of her. Living in the magnificence of Burgundy, Kriemhild dreamt she feared a falcon, strong, handsome, and wild, but that two eagles rent it while she perforce looked on, the most grievous thing that could ever befall her. Her mother, Ute, interprets her dream as a foreshadowing of mortal sorrow. Kriemhild is destined to lose a mighty husband. Why do you talk to me of a man, dear mother? I intend to stay free of a warrior's love all my life. I mean to keep my beauty till I die, and never be made wretched by the love of any man. Down the Rhine, in the splendid, far-famed city of Zanten in the Netherlands, there grew up a royal prince, a gallant knight named Siegfried, son of Siegmund. In the panoply of wealth and warriors, the boy grew up without want. When Siegfried came of age, he was knighted in midsummer, and mass was sung to the glory of God. A day came when tales of Kriemhild's beauty reached Siegfried. The brave prince was well endowed to win the hearts of lovely women, but seeing that he aspired to a constant love, his kinsmen and vassals counseled him to woo a lady of suitable standing. "There," Siegfried declared, "I shall take Kriemhild, the fair maiden of Burgundy." King Siegmund seeks to dissuade his son of this youthful endeavour, remarking on the protective nature of Kriemhild's brothers. But Siegfried is unyielding, and his doting father provides him with all the advantages his son may need for his success. A week later, Siegfried's valiant company rode to Gunther's land. Upon their arrival, King Gunther asks his brother Hagen the identity of these mysterious knights. Hagen then provides a lengthy tale of Siegfried's deeds. He had, in ages past, felled a mighty dragon, and, bathing in its blood, his skin had become impenetrable. What's more, he had vanquished Nibelung and other princes who had sought claim for the dragon's plunder. And so, with many bodies slain about him, Siegfried accrued a hoard of the dragon's wealth, taking it back to the Netherlands, where he ruled with his father in a mighty empire. The men of Burgundy ask of Siegfried's intentions. "This I shall not hide from you. I was told repeatedly in my father's country that the bravest warriors that king ever had were to be found with you, and I have come to see for myself. I have also heard such warlike qualities ascribed to you that a more valiant prince was never seen. Nor shall I desist until I know the truth of it. I, too, am a warrior, and am entitled to wear a crown, but I wish to achieve the reputation of possessing a land and people in my own sole right, for which my head and honour shall pledge. Now, since you are so brave, and I do not care who minds, I will wrest from you by force all that you possess. Your lands and your castles shall all be subject to me." King Gunther and his court are alarmed by such unprovoked aggression. Gernot justly asks why such conflict is necessary, when there would be small honour for them and little reward for the prince. Tactfully, the Burgundians welcome Siegfried and his men to their keep. Whilst guesting in Worms, Siegfried accompanies its lords to their hunts and feasts. But in all the time he stays at King Gunther's court, he never so much as catches a glance of Kriemhild. In time, Siegfried has been their guest for an entire year, when tidings reach Gunther's lands of the sovereigns of Saxony and Denmark's desire to make war on his people. Mighty Gunther is deeply downcast, but after holding council, he marshals his men, and Siegfried offers his sword, Balmung, in defence of Gunther's realm. The war is a great victory for the Burgundians, who bring the two foreign kings back as prisoners of war. And Siegfried returns to a hero's welcome. There is a great feast in honour of King Gunther's allies, and it is during these celebrations that Siegfried first meets Lady Kriemhild. She emerges like the dawn from the dark clouds. He sees the adorable maiden standing there. In all her splendour, her beauty is unmatched, and she greets him becomingly. "You are welcome, Lord Siegfried, noble knight," said she. Siegfried's spirit soared at this greeting, and he bowed his devoted thanks. Then she took him by the hand, and how ardently did this lord walk beside the lady, exchanging tender looks with her in secret. Soon they share each and every day in one another's company, and their shared joy and admiration blossoms into love. Fresh tidings soon arrive in the kingdom, not of war, but of beauty. In distant Iceland, a powerful queen rules from her fortress of Eisenstein. Brunhild is her name, a shield maiden of colossal strength and will, and King Gunther elects to tame her spirit and take her to be his wife. And thus it is that Gunther, Siegfried, Hagen, and Dankwart sail for Iceland. Gunther's resolve and recognition of the chances of failure leads him to make a pact with noble Siegfried. If Siegfried will aid him in winning Brunhild, then the king will assent to Siegfried marrying Kriemhild. It is agreed upon, and entering Brunhild's realm, she greets Siegfried as first of his company. Yet the knight corrects her and proclaims that he serves the Rhinish king. Brunhild declares that if Gunther means to claim her, then he shall have to best her in a contest of strength. Should Gunther lose, then his life and the life of his companions will be forfeit. Brunhild's strength was clearly tremendous, for they brought a heavy boulder to the ring for her, round and of monstrous size. 12 lusty warriors could barely carry it. And this she would always hurl after throwing her javelin. The Burgundians' fears rose high at the sight of it. "Mercy on us," said Hagen. "What sort of a lover has the king got here? Rather she should be the devil's drab in hell." But the men of the Rhine mean to play a game of deception. Siegfried has in his possession a cloak of invisibility that he gained from the dwarf Alberic. So it is that as Gunther goes through the motions, Siegfried does the deeds. The valiant knight hurls his javelin and boulder further than the shield maiden can match, and completes his victory by leaping beyond what he can even throw, even as he is carrying Gunther in his arms. Brunhild is astonished, but holds to her word and pledges to marry King Gunther. She merely asks for some time so that she may appoint trusted men to govern in her name in Iceland before departing for her new life in Burgundy. During this time, Siegfried employs his magic cloak once more to sneak down to their ship and bring back men from his realm in Nibelungenland, as a precaution if Brunhild means to double-cross them. Their ships are unmoored and they sail for home. Brunhild arrives in Worms to a city in jubilance. All are eager to gaze upon their new queen. Lady Kriemhild comes forward with great elegance. "Welcome to my mother and to me, here in this country, and to all the loyal friends we have." The city is aglow with revelry and mirth, none more so than in the heart of Siegfried, who finally receives the blessing of Gunther to marry Kriemhild. The two couples retire to their respective bedchambers, and we are told that Lord Siegfried's pastime was to his vast contentment. For as he lay with the young lady and inured her so tenderly in his noble loves, she became as dear to him as life, and he would not have exchanged her for 1,000 others. But for King Gunther, his knight is only characterized by humiliation. When he attempts to touch Brunhild, she resists his advances, and as Gunther more forcefully tries to assert his will, Brunhild wrestles with the king, binds him with her own girdle, and hangs him from the wrists upon his own wall. She had put a stop to his lovemaking. As to him, he all but died, such strength had she exerted. When Brunhild awakens the next morning, she bargains her chastity with the king and removes him from the wall. Gunther later confides in Siegfried, who has proven his loyalty countless times over and is now amongst Gunther's closest friends. The two conspire to use the magic cloak again. So that night, when the candles go out and the room darkens, Siegfried tries to tame the will of Brunhild. But even the mightiest knight struggles. She took tremendous revenge on him for having ruffled her clothes. What could his huge strength avail him? She showed him that her might was the greater, for she carried him with irresistible force and rammed him between the wall and the coffer. "Alas," thought the hero, "if I now lose my life to a girl, the whole sex will grow uppish with their husbands forever after, though they would otherwise never behave so." Summoning all of his strength, Siegfried bests her. And, believing herself bested by her husband Gunther, she declares, "I shall make ample amends for all I have done to you, and shall never again repel your noble advances, since I have found to my cost that you know well how to master a woman." Siegfried then leaves Gunther to his knight, but in a fateful decision, he takes with him a single ring from Brunhild's hand, as well as her girdle. In those days, it seems that all was just and well. The realms of Burgundy and the Netherlands were on good terms. Both Gunther and Siegfried each had the wife of their desires, and the strength of these great men enforced peace. After many years, Siegfried decides it is time to return to his own kingdom with his wife, so that she might meet her father-in-law, King Siegmund. In time, a son is born from the union of fair Kriemhild and her gallant husband. But back in Burgundy, Brunhild's restlessness mounts. if Siegfried is Gunther's vassal, as she had been informed, why does he not come pay homage? And if Siegfried is Gunther's vassal, then how can he possibly give away his own sister to him? If such a claim was false, what other deceptions has she been subjected to? Eventually, King Gunther relents as she insists that Siegfried must return with his wife, as she simply misses them so dearly. So, King Siegmund, with Siegfried and Kriemhild, travel to Burgundy, where they are once more heralded as friends. Alas, then, that their arrival marks the beginnings of unnumbered sorrows of many a brave knight. Brunhild presses Kriemhild on which of their husbands is the superior warrior, and in the course of their debate, Kriemhild confirms Brunhild's fears. Not only is Lord Siegfried not subservient to Gunther, but by way of the ring, she presents Brunhild with conclusive proof that she has been deceived and her honour besmirched. Both Gunther and Siegfried deny all knowledge of such a ruse, but conspiracy now abounds. Many a knight professes a desire to kill noble Siegfried for the dishonour he has brought upon the queen. Thus, those warriors declared themselves his enemies, though he had done them no wrong. Yet none followed Ortwin's proposal, except Hagen kept putting it to Gunther that if Siegfried was no more, Gunther would be lord of many kingdoms, at which Gunther grew very despondent. The king followed his vassal's advice to evil effect, and those rare knights began to set afoot the great betrayal before any might discover it, so that, thanks to the wranglings of two women, countless warriors met their doom. Gunther and Hagen devise a plan to have false news of war brought to court. With wretched deceit, Hagen then approaches Kriemhild and asks that she might trust him to know Siegfried's weaknesses, so that he may protect his brother in arms from deathly peril. Kriemhild's choice to trust Hagen will haunt her until her last day, as she explains that when her husband bathed in the blood of the dragon, a leaf landed on his back between his shoulder blades, and sews a cross upon his tunic so that Hagen knows precisely where to guard. The army musters, and Siegfried believes he rides to war and glory, but fresh tidings arrive that their adversaries have already sued for peace. So, deprived of hopes of conquest, Gunther, Hagen, and Siegfried take their entourage hunting, and it is there that the legendary Siegfried is betrayed, as Hagen's spear smites him, and we are told, no warrior will ever do a darker deed. Far away, Kriemhild knows in her heart that her husband is slain. Her dream returns, and the sight of his body, lifeless and bloody, brings her to grief beyond words, and all the days of her life are marked with forlorn despair and fury. She swears that she will kill Hagen. King Siegmund beseeches Kriemhild to return with him to Nibelungenland, where she might still take comfort in raising her son, but Kriemhild chooses to stay amongst her kin. Time does not diminish her sorrow, and to add further insult, Hagen has the treasure of the Nibelungs, won by Siegfried in his days of valour, brought to Burgundy, it being just as Kriemhild's dowry. The once fair lady wastes her days away with unnumbered tears, yet always seeking the means to avenge her true love. Though this shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, given the trajectory of the narrative you can already see unfurling before you, the Nibelungenlied is not going to end very happily at all, and the part two, when we get into it, is going to nosedive into even more death and murder and betrayal, rather than feel like worrying about spoiling a story that's 800 years old for you, much older based on the oral tradition. I feel like it makes sense to at least just be able to explain things in the context of where the story is going and all the rest of it. But as I say, there is so much to unpack that there will be more than enough to talk about when we get to discussing part two next week. As you can tell here with characters like Siegfried, some of them aren't exactly already making it to part two. So some of them are worth talking about here and now, and some of the other characters will be better discussed when we get to that. Another thing to say as well is that you can tell from the very beginning of the Nibelungenlied that it starts out in total romance. Kriemhild is the most beautiful, Burgundy is the most wondrous place, Siegfried is the most valiant, his empire is the most mighty. It really feels entirely in keeping with that prose of the romances of the time. And obviously, as you can see, as things goes on, things get more and more nasty. And what's more, it's important to remember as well that Kriemhild, in many senses, seems to be the quote-unquote hero of the story, not Siegfried, because part two is very much taken up with her quest for revenge, her quest for justice against her wrongly murdered husband. Fortunately, also to help me with analysing and talking all about this epic text, I actually have Thomas Carlyle to aid me with it, because Carlyle was one of the, although he never wrote a full translation of the Nibelungenlied into English himself, he was very, very skilled in speaking German. And so in 1831, I believe it was, he actually wrote an extensive essay analysing the text and bringing a very new knowledge of it to people here in Britain. And so I've also got quotes from just some of his observations on it as well that I think are worth reading. Carlyle points out, it may be observed that the poet here, and at all times, shows a marked partiality for Kriemhild, ever striving, unlike his fellow singers, to magnify her worth, her faithfulness, and loveliness, and softening as much as may be whatever makes against her. Much like Beowulf, the Nibelungenlied is full of characters coming to grips with doom, right? Doom in the old pagan sense of the word. Much like Beowulf as well, you can see a Christian text at work on an older pagan story.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Are we exposed? Security teams ask this every day. Vulnerabilities across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos hide the truth, and attackers are watching. Tenable unifies your tools, teams, and data so you can spot and close risks fast. Tenable's AI-powered exposure management gives teams one view of risk, helping them focus, take action, and close critical exposures fast. Visit Tenable.com. Tenable, your exposure ends here.